Welcome to Communities at the Crossroads. Thanks for coming out this evening. The weather timing was exactly wrong, but we're going to have a pleasant evening, and hopefully a few more will get here. We're going to hear about exciting new alliances and initiatives that are taking us down the road to a green economy just when we need it. The beauty of this is that health and prosperity and clean energy and clean environment can all go together and even help our most disadvantaged communities. I'm Dave Masson, event coordinator for Democracy Action. Democracy Action grew out of the 2004 Kerry campaign and is just celebrating its first anniversary as a chartered Democratic club in San Francisco. We focus on federal and statewide general elections and on issues of national importance, and we support like-minded grassroots groups. Our other co-sponsors tonight are the San Francisco Democratic Party, which is increasing its statewide impact by starting a permanent precinct captain program in San Francisco. San Francisco for Democracy is our sister group, which grew out of Howard Dean's campaign, and they're part of a national network, and we often work and party with them. Sierra Club is here, and they are strongly supporting community choice energy, which is something that we'll hear about tonight. Our media co-sponsors are EcoTalk, Air America Radio, and the Bay Area's KQKE, the Quake 960 AM, which broadcasts Betsy's EcoTalk program. We thank all our co-sponsors for their help and support and publicity, and you will find literature about them on the tables in the back. Thanks also to all our volunteers tonight, our heroes. I want to personally thank Democracy Action's president, Alec Bash, for all his support, and Jennifer Hammond for introducing us to Betsy Rosenberg. Most especially, I want to thank my talented partners in planning this event. It wouldn't have happened without you, and that is Debbie Friedman from Betsy Rosenberg's office and Aaron Israel from the Sierra Club. And they're in the back. Please give a wave and give them a hand. Thanks a lot, you guys. And finally, thanks to Jay Roller here at the Unitarian Church, who was so helpful handling all our changes, and Jonathan Silk in the back, who is recording the event. So tonight is a collaboration between the environmental groups and the more straight-ahead political groups, and we hope that that's something that's going to continue. The political groups tonight are here mainly to listen and learn how we can help. After the panel discussion, there will be time for questions, and after that, we'll talk about concrete actions we can take. During the panel, if you write down a question on one of the cards that you find at your seat, a volunteer will pick it up and bring it up to Betsy to use when the questions actually start. And we also have a microphone for that. Since we are recording the event, I actually have a special note from the sound technician. Everyone, please take your time and speak directly into the microphone. And during Q&A times, please speak up. Restrooms are outside the room and to the left. And so if there's nothing I've forgotten or there's no questions about what we're doing tonight, it's time for the talent to take over. Betsy Rosenberg, our moderator tonight, is an award-winning broadcast journalist who has worked for three major networks over the course of her 25 years in radio and TV. Betsy has been with the CBS Radio News Network for the past two decades, working as a reporter and anchor on KCBS AM in San Francisco and as a national newscaster for the CBS Radio News Network in New York. In addition to earning dozens of awards during her years of general reporting, Betsy has received 6 honors at the local, regional, and national levels for excellence in environmental leadership, including an award from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2001. Realizing the environment was perhaps the biggest underreported story of our time, Betsy has made it her exclusive beat, and in so doing, has become the voice for a greener America. She also offers sound solutions for a healthier planet through speaking engagements across the country to educators, business leaders, and civic groups, as well as appearances at environmental events, including Bioneers, Soul Sunfest, Greenfest, and the Health and Harmony Festival. Media outreach appearances have included ongoing television interviews on CNN Headline News, as well as several feature newspapers and magazine articles. Betsy lives with her husband and daughter in Marin County, California, where she walks the EcoTalk by recycling, composting, driving a hybrid car, and being energized by a well-insulated house and 18 solar panels on her roof. So please join me in welcoming a true hero for our environment, and a multitasker extraordinaire, Betsy Rosenberg.
Thank you for that nice introduction, and thank you for everyone who worked so hard to put this evening together. I am not one of those people. We did something for Democracy Action. How long ago was it?
Last August.
So a little over about 7 months ago. I think in large part because Debbie Friedman, who was very friendly with Jennifer Hammond and had come to work for me, was aware of this Democracy Action group. And I said, have they done much on the environment? She said, I don't know. I'll find out. And inquired. And sure enough, I don't know if nothing had been scheduled in terms of, you know, discussion topics. Very little had been. So we put together this panel, and it was very well received. And afterwards, we were all kind of fired up and said, this is so exciting to hear different people working in different aspects of the environment who are living solutions, not just talking about the problems. And I said, hey, if you want to put together more of these events, I'm happy to, you know, there's people I interview every week from all aspects of the green world, and it's growing all the time, happily. I can give you some great speakers, and I can show up. I don't have time to plan anything, so they put this all together. And I'm quite sure this room would be standing room only if we weren't having a likely global warming-induced intense storm out there tonight. It's pouring. I don't know if I'd go out if I didn't have to tonight. So thank all of you who made the effort, and I promise you, you'll not be disappointed. We have a fabulous panel. I can't wait to hear what they have to say. I learn every day, and the reason I do my radio show, because it doesn't pay, I actually have to pay for it. That's what's wrong with the environment today, but don't get me started. And the way we value or don't value the environment in our society, not the environment's fault, is the people I get to interview. I am so inspired by the eco-pioneers out there in every sector now, the stewards who are living solutions, and they're at the Bioneers, and they're at Greenfest, and they're here tonight. So I hope you'll be as inspired as I've been. I just had the chance to interview Ken from my KCBS Green Minute. He'll be on for the rest of the week if any of you catch EcoTalk on KCBS, which used to be Trash Talk. And garbage has turned into global warming. It's amazing how this passion for waste or a distaste for waste has taken me 9 years later to covering what I think is the biggest story of our time. And it just keeps growing. And pretty soon, any day now, our culture is going to start valuing the kind of work and information and efforts and consciousness that so many people have been working far longer than I have. 10 years ago, I would not have called myself an environmentalist. If we have time, maybe I'll tell you how that happened. But Carla just asked me, and hearing about all my greenness, am I a vegetarian? And I'm not. So I have a long way to go. That is going to be the next step. I hear there's a movie that once I watch it, I'll never eat meat again. And Debbie is a vegetarian, so she walks the EcoTalk more than I do, now that she's driving a Prius especially. Do you have solar panels yet, Debbie? Not yet. Soon. So there's always more we can do, right? And it's not about being perfect, and it's not about being holier than thou. It's about informing and inspiring as we all learn together about what we are doing to our home, our life support system, and connecting the dots for people to really make better choices. So tonight is exciting because we're going to be discussing what's really going on in communities that's working. And I know about Ken's story just because I had the chance to interview him. You will be inspired, I promise you. He's a foster father who has taken that work, combined it with his Sierra Club work, and is creating what we call a win-win-win situation. And Supervisor Maxwell, of course, has been working tirelessly. I've known about her environmental work for years. And Carla Dinn, I just had the pleasure of meeting tonight, but the Apollo Alliance is one of my favorite groups. I point to that often as a solution. And we just need to, you know, get more people to be part of the congregation, to be looking for solutions, and to be publicizing the solutions. I say my piece is being the communications vehicle, going to environmental conferences, started out with recycling conferences, which who knew? There'd be like 2,000 people there. This is back in 1997 when I launched EcoTalk on Earth Day. It so happens it was the first garbage strike in 57 years in San Francisco. So I thought I'd be the only one talking about garbage, but that day I was like the 12th story about garbage when my feature launched on KCBS. But back then, there wasn't a lot of, you know, information about this, and there wasn't a lot of solutions to point to. It was really just beginning to look at some of the problems our waste causes in so many different ways. So it's been an interesting journey. It's a beat that I'll never get tired of, much to my husband's frustration. He says, doesn't your passion ever stop? Stop talking about it. It's gotten into my blood. You know, I see the world through green-tinted lenses, although these are not my usual glasses. These are my backup pair. So if I can't see all of you out there, it's just because of the lenses between you and me. It's something that is so interesting to me. It's so compelling, and especially when you focus on successes. It's a topic area that we never run out of ideas. I mean, every week it's what are we not going to cover? And so I hope, have you all heard EcoTalk, the national version? It's on Saturday afternoons from 12 to 1 p.m. on 960 a.m. A little plug because we work very hard to bring you that show, and we have really who's who in the world of environmental stewards. And I think you'll find it quite interesting. Everything from the religious communities waking up to global warming, that was this week's show. Last week we had Dennis Weaver, the actor who passed away. Of course, the actor from Gunsmoke, but many people didn't realize that after he retired from acting, he took up environmental activism and was promoting clean car technology, you know, 5-7 years ago before it was popular. And that was what he was most proud of, not his acting career. I had a chance to interview him. And his legacy is going to continue on. We try to cover the stories that the rest of mainstream media doesn't. And that's been very easy because there was hardly any coverage up until this past year. But thanks to Katrina, Wilma, Rita, and Oprah, as I add, it's now on the map, global warming. Did you guys catch that? Oprah did a whole hour on the environment with Leo DiCaprio with an emphasis on global warming and fuel efficiency and fossil fuels being the problem. And I thought, this has got to be a turning point of some kind. The best moment was when Oprah, after seeing this little video clip about SUVs, turned to Leo and said, does this mean I'm going to have to give up my SUVs? And Leo had a good answer. He said, no, but maybe you should get the hybrid version, something like that. So, you know, there's always a better version of whatever we're doing, whether it's clothes, whether it's food, whether it's the cars we drive, it's the green building supplies that we use. And that's the exciting part. This is really emerging, if not exploding. And it's really more exciting than depressing, I would say. Sometimes the forecast can be a little despairing, but the point is we have a choice, and we can do nothing, and the news will get worse, most certainly. Or we can take our heads out of the sand, open up our eyes. Tomorrow will depend on what we do today. And the moment is now. So those of you who are here, obviously you get it. I'm talking to the choir. But I hope each of you will go out and be ambassadors where you live, where you work, and just look around and say, what can I do to green my environment? And that's really where it starts. It starts in our own backyard. So without further delay, I'd like to welcome our first panelist, Sophie Maxwell. You may not know that Sophie is a native of San Francisco. And she was elected to the Board of Supervisors 6 years ago in 2000, and she represents District 10, which encompasses the Potrero Hill, Bayview Hunters Point, Visitation Valley, Portola Silver Terrace, Dog Patch, I hadn't heard about that, and Little Hollywood, Portola, and other surrounding neighborhoods. She was reelected in 2002. Obviously, she's doing something right. I'd say everything right. And she's the chair of both the Board's Land Use Committee and the Select Committee on Ending Gun and Gang Violence. Supervisor Maxwell's main priorities are economic development, cleaning up the Bayview Hunters Point shipyard, closing the polluting power plants, and there's some good news on that front she'll tell you about that just happened, increasing public safety through promoting better police and community relations, increasing child care and after-school programs to engage and inspire youth and young adults, expanding affordable housing and opportunities, and preserving open space. So please help me welcome Sophie Maxwell.
Well, I really have to open with the great news that we had this week. But I have to also mention a very important person to me in here, and that's Linda Richardson. Linda and I start working on that power plant many, many years ago. And I've been in office 6 years, and I've been working on it ever since I got into office. But we started a long time, and she started before me. And she got me really involved. My son was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so I started thinking, oh, wait a minute, you messed with the wrong mother's son here. And so I started thinking about what can I do. And I lived in Bayview Hunters Point. I could see both stacks from my window. The sewage plant was right down the street. And so I just wanted to be involved, and I wanted to do something. And so I ran into Linda, and she said, look, come to this meeting. And, you know, I got bitten by the bug, and I've been there ever since. And my son died from Hodgkin's lymphoma. But I think it was just, I mean, I try to use everything as positive. Everything is energy. And so his death just energized me, his illness, to do something for the environment and for this community. And so as we were fighting the plant, and we were sitting around a table, group of us, environmentalists, people who've been working from in the community and different communities, and we were thinking, what can we do? What can we do? We ought to have a policy to talk about, to get rid of Mirant was the first one, which was a corporation that was dealing in power plants and working in the city. And so we came up with a plan. And we said, why don't we have an energy plan for San Francisco? And so through all of us working together and with the legislation that I introduced and the board passed it, it was 2001 in May, and San Francisco had its first energy plan. And the energy plan emphasized clean energy and renewable energy. And basically was saying we can't use, you know, Mirant needs to go because this is not a part of our plan. And that's the way we helped to get rid of Mirant. And that's the way we got the city more involved. We had the city departments, and the city departments, it was the Department of the Environment and the PUC that had to really go around and come up with this plan. But in the legislation, they had to go to every district in the city. They had to go to all the communities, the business community, so we could get everybody involved in this plan. And indeed, we did. And I think this plan, I know this plan, is really helping us and going to continue helping San Francisco on its way to a better and cleaner environment. And then there was another opportunity really to put, we had passed the precautionary principles in 2003, and we had an opportunity to have the first real effort to put it into practice. And that was legislation I was able to author and pass in 2005, which, again, using the Department of the Environment, said that we had to use green products. And it wasn't about the cost. It was about the green. And that has saved San Francisco so much money, more than we ever thought. And it certainly has saved workers, their health. We've noticed and we correlated their health and time off, and we found that to be effective. And so the greening, and also we've helped to deal with people, businesses, and saying, okay, well, then there's a market. There's a market for green and energy efficient and green fluorescent bulbs. And so we helped to make that happen. And we're working with Berkeley and other municipalities around our city, around the city, and the region to even make a bigger difference. And then there was the green business program that we just did actually in January. And that's giving green businesses, people who want to be environmentally sensitive, we're giving them some kudos. We're saying, okay, if you do this, then there's a program for you. And we will give you a star, and wherever you go, you can say that you are a green business and you are certified by San Francisco. Well, the first time we did it, we started a pilot, and we had 70 businesses that applied, and we had 25 really that went through the program, and we had more and more people wanting to. And so now the pilot has become an ordinance, and that's what we do in San Francisco. And so those are just a couple of the things that I'm really most proud of. And then next is, for me, and I think very, very important, I think, is water. You know, water is something that we sometimes see as a nuisance instead of a resource. And I want us to start looking at water differently. I want us to start looking at water as what it is. I've gone to water conferences that San Francisco never goes to, and people say, who is the city that flushes potable water down the toilet? And then they go on and on. And then they, I'm sorry, Sophie. We don't mean to be so harsh, but San Francisco really needs to do a better job. And these are other municipalities in our state that have groundwater. We are very, have underground water. We are very lucky to have top water. And we don't treat it very well. And I think there's got to be a program, and we've got to look at, I'm looking at the general plan and how we use water. And I'm looking also at the PUC and seeing if there's a way that we can mesh these two so it can really be a part of what we do and how we build. Then there's another environmental issue that is very close to me, and that's violence and poverty and racism in San Francisco. Those are environmental issues, folks, and I wish you could feel it, and I could look out in the audience when we're talking about it, when we have hearings, and I see you there because it's an environmental issue. I wish more people would understand what is happening to our city. And it's from Nob Hill. We have a Katrina every day in the housing project, and nobody's talking about green. Nobody's talking about energy efficiency. No one. And these people are living in Katrina conditions all the time. It's hard for them to talk about or think about greening when they're just thinking about living. That should not be the case in San Francisco. And so that's my next environmental issue that I'd like to have you all. And, you know, and I just think if 120 dogs had been killed last year on the streets of San Francisco, shot, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. There'd be more legislation and more hearings and more whatever else. But just black males, young, between the ages of 15 and 24, not a word, not a peep from any of you. And so that concerns me about the environment. It concerns me, and I know we're all thinking about, and we're one-pointed and we're focused, but just broaden yourselves to people just a little bit. And who we're talking about, that most of the women in the world do what? They carry water. Most of the women in the world, most of the women of color carry water. And so there's so many things that we could do, and I almost feel like some of these women in the housing projects right here in San Francisco probably are doing the same thing. I wouldn't be surprised. So I think if we all would broaden our perspective, and that's what I'm going to be working on. And when you asked if there's anything I'd like you to help me with, well, that's it. I'd like you to help me with that. I'd like you to think about those things and those people. And just think about them, however, if they're light bulbs or green or brown or, you know, whatever you have to think about it, I would like to see that. I'm having hearings all the time on foster care, and I know I'm going off a little bit, but you asked me to be first. But you may not realize this, but 70% of the young men that are in state prisons have been in our foster care system, 90% nationwide. 60% of the young men who have been killed in San Francisco and who were the killers were in our foster care system. Those are our children. Those are ours. And where are they? We don't even know, because in San Francisco, 50% of them are out of our county. And so when you think about programs, when you think about teaching, when you think about the stewards, well, who are they going to be? They need to be these young men. And that's what we need to think about. So those are some of the things that I'm working on, and I would like your help. And if you don't want to come to a hearing, email somebody. Email your supervisors and ask them to be involved. Thank you.
I think that was exactly 10 minutes, and I haven't even been timing you. Just right. Thank you. And we will be doing questions after we hear from each of our panelists. We want to have questions from you, and I may have a few, and you can even ask each other questions. And since you all worked so hard to get here on this rainy night, if we go a few minutes over, is that okay? Since we started a few minutes late, I hope. Yes, you won't want to leave, I promise you. Our next speaker is Carla Dinn, and she is the Western Regional Field Director for the Apollo Alliance and also represents the United Steelworkers. Since 2004, Ms. Dinn has developed policy strategies for the Alliance to create high-quality jobs and reduce dependence on imported oil while applying best practices for workers and our environment. In 2002, Ms. Dinh's outreach to California labor organizations led to overwhelming labor support for California's renewable portfolio standard, which requires California to generate 20% of its electricity from renewable energy by 2017. And I think San Francisco has a goal of 50% renewable energy. Is there a target date for that?
No.
As soon as we can. Yes. As soon as we can. We'll do it, too. Prior to joining the steelworkers, Ms. Dinh campaigned with the Rose Foundation for Communities and the Environment, urging the Maxim Corporation to improve the destructive logging operations of the Pacific Lumber Company and to reform the labor practices of Kaiser Aluminum. This culminated in the California State Teachers Retirement Fund's divestment of its Maxim stock. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Betsy, for that nice introduction. And a special thanks to Dave Masson of the Democracy Action Project and Aaron Israel from the Sierra Club for your great organizing. I also wanted to commend Supervisor Maxwell for your incredible accomplishments. Well, since the Apollo Alliance incorporates many different perspectives, I thought I'd start off with a little story about that topic, perspectives. An elderly man who had lived a very long, rich, and satisfying life was laying at his deathbed. And in his near-comatose state, he was awakened by the aroma of baking chocolate chip cookies wafting from the kitchen downstairs below. So he mustered up all the strength he could find to lift himself out of bed, wander down the hallway and down the stairs. With his last remaining energy, he was leaning against the doorway, looking into the kitchen in disbelief, because there were hundreds and hundreds of chocolate chip cookies being baked by his wife. And he thought, oh, my God, is my beloved wife so dedicated? She, in her last effort to make me leave life as a happy person, bake me my favorite cookies. And so he reached his shaking hand over to a cookie, which he could already taste in his parched lips. And his wife immediately slapped his hand with a spatula and said, stay away. Those are for your wake. Well, the Apollo Alliance is an alliance of very different perspectives, and that includes business, labor, social justice groups, as well as environmental. And some of our local partners include the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and the Urban Agenda, based in Oakland, as well as the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council. On the labor side, we have the support of 20 international organizations across the country, including the California Labor Federation and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. In California, our two most recent members of the steering committee include Sharp Solar, as well as Community Fuels, which is a startup biodiesel company. As many of you may know, the Apollo Alliance was named after President Kennedy's Apollo space mission in 1961, when he set as a goal to land a man on the moon in 10 years. And Apollo works with the same level of urgency to reach greater energy independence within one generation. And in the effort, we hope to unify the different stakeholders to build political power. Because as many of you are probably aware, when you don't have buy-in from many of the different parties at the outset, there's great potential for heartache down the road. Our goals in a nutshell are to increase domestic investments in clean energy, to create high-quality jobs, and to provide training opportunities in modern energy technologies, to revitalize our communities, such as in the Bayview Hunters Point and West Oakland, as well as to boost industries and business along the way. For every dollar that's invested abroad in foreign oil, that means one less dollar invested at home. And a lot of the jobs that we're trying to create are in industries that cannot be outsourced, and that means we're keeping the dollars at home. And I'd like to put this in context by talking about some of the challenges that Apollo seeks to address. Over the past 3.5 years, we've seen the loss, the overwhelming loss of over 3 million manufacturing jobs in America. These are high-quality, middle-class jobs that are being replaced with low-paid service and retail jobs. In California alone, according to the Los Angeles Times, we've lost 540,000 manufacturing jobs, which is devastating. These are due to outsourcing, mergers, bankruptcies, as well as globalization. We're also trying to bring people up from the ground level to improve urban blight and divestment and to stop some of the loss of the industrial lands and local jobs that accompany those lands when they turn over to residential development. And a number of cities in California are actually taking steps to impose or to implement policies that can protect the land. For instance, if you take half an acre of land, that could mean 10, 20, 30, 40 jobs. But, you know, put a few homes in there and those jobs are lost forever. Climate change is another major area that we're addressing. As Supervisor Maxwell mentioned, the Merritt Power Plant was one of the contributors to the emissions of greenhouse gases there. It is responsible. Power plants are responsible for 40% of carbon dioxide emissions in California. And as you may know, these are located in low-income communities, mainly where people of color live and where people have very little political power. And as the result, they suffer from significant health, environmental, and economic hazards. For instance, if you just take public health problems separately, asthma rates are astronomical in these communities on a class basis. In households where people are earning $15,000 and less, their rate of asthma is 37% higher than households where people earn at least $50,000. And sulfur dioxide, another pollutant, may be responsible for the premature deaths of over 30,000 people in America every year. Now, from a global perspective, in America, we make up 5% of the world's population, and yet we consume 25% of the energy in the world. We're 60% dependent on oil. And we spend hundreds of billions of dollars to protect, with our military, the Middle East oil supplies that make up about 50% of oil in the world. And many of the remaining potential sources are in countries like Nigeria and Africa, where they have unstable political regimes. But some people are benefiting quite a bit. If you follow Congress, you'll know that the top five oil companies earned more than $100 billion last year. Now, in California, the majority of our electricity is generated by natural gas, but we also consume vast amounts of oil here for transportation, largely. In 2004, we consumed about 15.4 billion gallons of petroleum. And to put that in perspective, that's over 50% of what we consumed 20 years ago. And this is due to the growth in population, preference for large vehicles like SUVs, as well as movement out to the suburbs where it requires a lot more driving to get from home to work. Our appetite for energy does not stop at state lines. For instance, many people do not know that Southern California is dependent on coal-generated energy that comes from out of state. 20% of the energy in California comes from coal-based power. And communities such as the Navajo and the Hopi in Arizona are pressured then to generate more coal from the mines on their reservations, making them further dependent on revenue coming from an energy source that is polluting their people as well as drawing water from very rare sources of water and aqueduct systems to channel that coal-based slurry over to Nevada. Hopefully we're going to be working together to transition communities such as these towards more renewable energy production. So that's the bleak backdrop. On the positive side, our plan, the Apollo Alliance plan, is one of investments, and that means investing about $300 billion in America in alternative energy. This is not just new money. We're looking at creative financing, such as public pension fund dollars, clean energy bonds, rebates, tax credits. And as the result, we expect to see over 3 million new jobs, about $284 billion in net energy cost savings, and a 50% decrease in reliance on foreign oil. The investments are mainly in areas such as renewable energy development, energy efficiency, hybrid car manufacturing, as well as green building, which is also a word for high-performance building. And as a gentleman here can attest from CleanEdge, there's a vast amount of venture capital money being poured into this industry. In fact, in 2005, more than $1.6 billion was invested, which is a 35% increase over 2004. And this is the fifth most popular sector after biotech, software, medical technology, and telecommunication. So that's a lot of money. But it seems rather nebulous, doesn't it? And how can we capture some of those economic development benefits for workers and for our communities? Well, Apollo is doing this in three main ways. One is through the best practices model, where we're trying to incorporate labor and environmental standards into initiatives, such as including apprenticeship standards and local hire provisions in legislation. We're also doing it through policy initiatives. My colleague, Jeremy Hayes, who's Western organizer for Apollo, successfully worked with the Colorado Apollo Alliance to get $19 million added to legislation that would go toward energy efficiency in low-income homes. On the project side, we're working locally with the West Oakland Apollo Alliance to create a program with the Ella Baker Center, as well as the Building and Construction Sector Initiative Collaborative, to train formerly incarcerated men in construction work so that they can learn green applications on projects in West Oakland and beyond that. And hopefully that will lead to employment on a new project that's very exciting. It's a 119-unit green building that's going up on a former polluted site of the Red Star Yeast Factory, which used to spew acetaldehyde into the community and was successfully driven away by the community after years of organizing. We also have efforts in San Francisco. The nascent San Francisco Green Jobs Program, led by the Office and Professional Employees Local 3, as well as partners such as the Chinese Progressive Association, to create a strategy of training and job placement for immigrants, such as laid-off garment workers, dislocated workers, as well as other low-income populations. California is also working to ensure high-quality jobs come out of the Green Wave Initiative. Some of you may have heard about this. It's an ambitious project by the public pension funds in California, CalPERS, the BMF $160 billion pension fund that's probably even larger than that today, and the state teachers' retirement system are investing millions of dollars in equity, private equity as well as public equity in clean technology. We're also looking at $200 million invested in energy efficiency in the properties in which they hold stock. That's a lot of money, but we want to make sure that those projects lead to new jobs for community-based workforce programs as well as some of the building trades partners that we have. We're also working to boost in-state biodiesel production, and Eric Bowen is a partner on this project from Sigma Capital. What we hope to do is to promote promote the agricultural sector in the Central Valley to grow oilseed crops as part of an integrative soil management system that will profit for that industry, reduce the pollution in the Central Valley, and lead to high-quality jobs. We're also beginning the process of laying the foundation for in-state hybrid car manufacturing. This is very early in the process, but we think it makes a whole lot of sense when you see that Californians make up 60% of the people buying hybrid cars in the country, and yet there's no manufacturing in California going on today. But we do have a very large plant in Fremont called the NUMMI plant, where the auto workers work, and great potential to turn two of their three cars into hybrid vehicles. So these are some of the approaches that we're taking, and just to give you a snapshot of some of the jobs that can come out of this, Apollo Alliance is working with Urban Habitat to create a community job study, which will lay out some of the lower-skilled jobs in these industries and the skills and training involved for them to take the next step. What we hope to do is to create a seamless transition from workforce community-based programs into higher-level state-approved apprenticeship programs that are sponsored by the Building Trades Council, for instance. There are more jobs involved in renewable energy than there are in conventional systems such as coal-based energy. Wind energy and photovoltaic solar offer 40% more jobs than coal. Energy efficiency projects create about 21 jobs for every $1 million investment. And these fields in energy efficiency are very compatible with some of our building trades partners, such as the electrical workers in solar energy, roofers that work with Energy Star roofing systems, and the glazers that deal with the building envelope or double pane windows. John Edwards, the former nominee for vice president, used to talk about the two Americas. one being the rich and powerful and the rest of us. And what Apollo seeks to do is to promote and shape the green economy of the future, and we hope that will benefit everybody. Thank you very much.
I was just handed a bottle of water and reminded that on next week's EcoTalk, we're going to be hearing about this new campaign. Bottled water is just an environmental disaster. They did testing, and it's no more pure than tap water anywhere. And getting the water is environmentally unfriendly, not to mention all the plastic waste. So, you know, we're all doing it, but it's not doing us any good. Our next panelist is a U.S. Navy veteran, marketing professional, and for the last 7 years, he raised, as a single father, a dozen fostered youth in San Diego. I thought I was busy. Wow. He's a former steel worker, a member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and serves the Sierra Club in a host of volunteer leadership roles, including State Climate Change and Energy Committee Chair of Sierra Club California. Please help me welcome Ken Smokoska.
Thank you, Betsy. And actually, I wanted to start with a moment of silence for actually all the guys and gals that are over in the war zones. And because I had happy news yesterday, actually, one of the youngsters that I raised found out that he landed stateside in Maine, so he's heading in transit back to California, and there's a bunch of us getting together for a ski trip, so that's going to be pretty cool. And what I want to share tonight is really how we link global warming, foster care, gang introduction, renewable energy, through community choice law solutions. So it's what is community choice? And who in the audience is familiar with the San Francisco implementation plan for community choice that's been going on for the last couple of years? Just a smattering? Half? Excellent. Well, what community choice law is it was enacted in 2002, and it allows communities to aggregate their buying power commensurate with the scale of the problem that we're dealing with climate change. San Francisco is going to, in the next 3 to 5 years, build out 50% renewable energy and energy efficiency in the city. They're going to do that with a meter beat rate from energy service providers and beat PG&E's rate. And when Carla was mentioning jobs, there's 700% more jobs for every megawatt of energy produced with solar versus a natural gas power plant. Look at all the side benefits that we get with that also. And this is going to be a little bit little unorthodox for a Sierra Club person getting up here. I'm going to talk about the kids first. And in San Diego, a program that we put together is called STEPS. And STEPS is a multi-agency program for disadvantaged youth. There's gang interdiction, there's emancipated foster youth that are built into that program. We're building our future with one kid at a time. And it starts off with a foundation of mentoring, job creation, some basic education. And what happens is, if you look at that picture for our live audience, sorry you can't see this, but the kids look a little fuzzy. That's because their future is very fuzzy. Actually, two-thirds of the homeless folks that are out there were in foster care. And a good chunk of others are in California Youth Authority by the age of 21. We're just failing that population. So when the first kids that I had living with me turned 18 a few years ago, they were saying all along that there was independent living programs available for the kids. They turn 18, come to find out there was a 9-month to a year waiting list for them housing for the kids. Where are they going to go? That's why they turn into homelessness. Actually, there's a state law that's being introduced by Murray in L.A., sponsored by John Burton here locally and his foundation for Children Without Homes, and that's going to address that problem. Only in 3 counties in the state are actually programs available. When the kids first came out of the system, there was one apartment for 2 kids available in North San Diego County. There's 500 kids on a waiting list for housing. You know, we're failing that population. So how are we going to take the steps to do that? Well, With my Sierra Club background in renewable energy, I had one little slice of the program. This program has county welfare, it's got health and human services, it's got probation department, it's got interfaith community services, it's got group homes, it's got the police chaplains. It's a well-rounded program, and I have just a little slice of it with the renewable energy construction project. And that's what community choice is going to bring for us, because what community choice is, it's a scale of renewable energy commensurate with the huge crisis that we have in global warming. In addition to San Francisco going with 50% renewable, there's over a dozen other cities throughout the state representing over 10% of the investor-owned utility power moving forward with a 40% or higher renewable energy content. You know, that's double the state standard. They're going to ramp it up city by city, community by community in this state, and they're going to do it in 3 to 5 years. Next month, we have energy service providers coming to City Hall in San Francisco. The city has a community choice task force. They're coming from across the country because they want part of this business, and they're going to be competitive with it. And how do you do it? You know, if you take a look at all the rooftops that are available in the city, right now there's such a small percentage that have any type of renewable energy on them. But if you take a look at our peak power in the summer, that peak power in the summer is just perfect with an overlay for renewables. So if you start to put the solar where you have that peak power, first, it's very expensive. That peak power, you know, we have shortages. It's a very simple, elegant solution to do it that way. And we can scale it up appropriately, especially, as Carla was mentioning, bringing jobs and manufacturing back to the states. You know, that next month also we have a group of solar manufacturers coming out, and we want them to build solar manufacturing in California. And we've been going up and down the state trying to build that capacity and that base with elected officials and also in the community. In the midst of the energy crisis in 2002, San Diego City Schools put out a request for proposal. What they did is they wanted a long-term power purchase contract, and they wanted an emphasis on renewables with that. Energy is the second largest budget line item for schools. It's probably the same for our local county government and city governments. And it's probably the same for after payroll with a lot of businesses. Well, what they were able to do is get a million square foot of installed roofing at no cost to the district. You think, how could they do that with no cost? What they did is GE Capital came in and they financed it. These schools needed new roofs, so they packaged it with new roofs. But what you're seeing is the first school, which is Andrew Jackson Elementary. That school was scheduled for a new roof in 2003, and what they got was a membrane roof with solar integrated to it. That roof is now going to take care of 90% of that annualized load for that school, but also, when that school is not in operation during the summer, that's peak going right back into the grid. The facility guys that we worked with in San Diego really liked this because the newer technology, this happens to be a very heavy-duty solar system. It's not your typical glass system. So it's basically they thought it was going to be vandal-proof and kid-proof because they never know what's going to be on the roofs with those schools. But if you take a look at all the schools that we have in the state, we have the potential for probably 2,500 megawatts of power. That equates to 5 good-sized power plants, probably 20 to 25 peaker plants. So just with our schools, we have the ability to restore some of our coast and also do the right thing. Part of the adjunct that happened with this is working with a local group home. It's called New Haven Youth and Family Services. It's a 72-bed facility. Now, New Haven works with very high level 13 kids is the term in health and human services. But basically, this is the last spot for these kids with severe mental disturbances and very high level foster care. Well, what they did is they developed a youth build program. And out of that youth build program about 2 years ago, the guys from New Haven poured the foundation, framed up their workshop, and they've started to build furniture. They've built pens. They've done so much stuff. The furniture that they've built, they call it New Haven Tough. The executive director down there at New Haven, Doreen, she would buy expensive furniture. The kids would destroy it. She'd buy cheap furniture. They'd destroy it. Now the kids building their furniture, they take care of it. They're proud. You know, they have a lot of self-esteem with that. This was developed as a therapeutic, but now it's turned into something more. You know, it's very positive. And so about a year and a half ago, we started to develop it with a green theme. And with the green theme, what we've developed is an expansion. From about 20 kids, it's going to grow to about 500 kids as it rolls out into the charter school. The youth are entering in this program from a number of different referrals. They could come from probation. They could come from Health and Human Services. They could come a self-referral. They could come from a parent referral. But what they're moving into is vocational training. When I heard the redevelopment agency at Hunters Point recently, the hearing last week, people were crying out. The kids were, and young adults were crying out, "We want a job. We want something to future. We're going to training, and we want a job when we come out." Well, that what we've done is we brought business partners in. We've brought renewable energy. We've got an IBEW contractor. He's got 8 guys working for him now installing solar. We've got a reclamation company that takes the scrap wood from the building sites and turns it into products. So this collaboration will create a very solid exit for the kids. The kids were going to have job opportunities. They're going to have a high school diploma or a GED. They're going to have some self-respect and self-esteem. And then as they graduate from that program, they have an opportunity to link right into the community college, into the regional occupational programs. There's sheet metal worker, there's steel workers, there's building trades. All those different trades are good, solid, livable, good future for the kids. So you've got kids that didn't really care about anything. They're at risk. They're troubled. Now all of a sudden they have a positive attitude. What else are they going to have? Well, the community is going to have a lot of deliverables with this. You know, if we can reduce our gang problem, if we can have a model for long-term sustainability with green construction, we're going to create some sustainability both for the kids and the environment. What happens with solar is it's been a little bit of a chicken and an egg syndrome. Well, if we scale up commensurate with the size that Community Choice is going to do in San Francisco and Los Angeles and Chula Vista and the San Joaquin Valley and Marin and Oakland and Berkeley, what you can do is you can aggregate all that buying power and truly scale it up. So when you scale it up that way, and you look at the technologies, you think about the satellites that have been up in space. You know, you read in the newspaper every once in a while, they say, well, this satellite's been up there about 15 years past its expected life. That's because the solar's been working so darn well. Well, so that you take that solar from the defense industry and put it down the roofs of our schools, we're going to create a lot of jobs for the kids. And we're going to do it in San Francisco first, because next month the Board of Supervisors is going to vote on community choice implementation. Because it's a real simple democratic process. You know, you can go community by community. We're starting here in San Francisco. I was in Fort Bragg at a town hall meeting a couple months back, and I didn't realize, but 4 of the elected officials for the town council were in the audience. So somebody had asked, how can we do community choice? I said, well, you just need to get 3 out of your 5 votes to move forward. And all the heads were moving in each direction, eyeballing all those elected officials. And they created a citizen task force, just what San Francisco's done. So what we're doing is we're replicating all the good things that San Francisco's done. And we're just going to roll that out city by city and community by community in the state. And why are we at the crossroads? We're at the crossroads because we're now considering bringing in liquefied natural gas into California. The Sierra Club magazine in 1978 had a 4-page article that talked about LNG on our coast and Point Conception. Well, right now, there's 15 LNG terminals proposed on the West Coast. There's 25 in the Gulf Coast states and 20 on the East Coast. Each of these proposed terminals end up being about $5 billion. Ratepayers are going to pay for that if those get built. I'd rather build solar on our schools than LNG on our coast. So, thank you.
We're at the crossroads of the CD. We're going to do a quick 2-minute break while they switch CDs. Don't leave. The best is yet to come. We have some fabulous questions coming up. We're going to talk about action steps, what each of us can leave here tonight with. And just to make sure you don't leave, I'm going to tell you a few jokes. Who can leave when there's jokes, right? They're not really jokes, but they're sort of funny stories. Have you noticed that there's no shortage of renewable energy sources? We've got the wind, it's free, it's abundant. Sun, it's free, it's abundant. Geothermal, there's always nuclear. Yeah, that's what their idea of renewable energy is, and clean coal, if there is such a thing. So it's not that we're lacking the power, it's that we're lacking the willpower to really make the transition to a greener economy. Are we turned over? Yeah? Okay, we're going to resume. What we'd like to do is ask all of you who have questions to write them down on your index card and pass them down to the end of the row. We have a few already, and if we run out of written questions, then feel free to come up to the microphone. We're going to spend about 10-15 minutes on questions. Thanks, Jen. And then we're going to each of our panelists will talk about action steps, something you can leave here tonight with. And if any of you in your work, like Ted Postumus, my friend from Green Collar Jobs, has been working on this long, long time, as long as I've been doing this beat, please, you know, feel free to share what you want to with this group. And this is sponsored by Democracy Action. This is a group that's all about action. Thanks for staying. Okay, first question. It's the one I just got, but since the other two are back there. This is a question for anyone. Everywhere, business is trying to cut labor costs by eliminating jobs. Your programs all stress job creation. How do you deal with this basic conflict with business?
I'll address that from a different angle. I think a business sector is realizing how important it is to work with other stakeholder groups. They see that there is value in collaborating with labor, with environmentalists, in order to drive certain initiatives forward. And in the process, we're trying to raise the bar for everybody. We're trying to apply a best practices model. So that's how we're trying to influence them, rather than looking at it from an internal point of view.
Well, through the city, I helped to institute what we're calling City Build. And we looked at all the billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of capital improvements that our city has. And so we thought, why not put all of this under one roof? And so we have with City College and community-based organizations all coming together, we have what we call City Build, and we're using the city to be able to put the screws into private business, private corporations and private builders, so that they understand that if they have a city contract, they need to hire from our city. And so we're trying to use the muscle of our city to do that, and I think it's working already. Our unions are coming on board slowly but surely, and it's going to be, I think, a very successful program.
Great. Another question for anyone. We had a national energy crisis in the early 1970s. I remember that. You guys old enough to remember that? We had an electricity crisis in 2001. Who could forget that crisis? People were engaged for a few years but then reverted back to their old ways. What is different now, or what has changed, so that this issue does not just fade away like it has in the past? And I would say these issues, because everything from pollution to global warming and beyond is affecting all of us.
Sierra Club had a summit here in San Francisco in September of last year. Overwhelmingly, energy was the number one priority for the club in the grassroots. So thousands of Sierra Club members came from across the country and said, energy is going to be our number one priority. It is our number one priority for the next 5 years, and a commitment from our board resolution last week. So we have a little staying power, so I think we'll be around on this issue today and in the future.
And I think in the city, we had a couple years ago Proposition H, which I co-sponsored with Tom Amiano, and was about solar energy and bonds. And the voters overwhelmingly supported bonds for solar energy and for renewable energy. So I think that at least in San Francisco and a lot of other places, people are aware of what's going on, and I think they're more aware about global warming than even our president, which is not very surprising.
Doesn't say much, right?
I'd just like to add to that, that this is a period of crisis and a period of opportunity because things are so bleak, and they're right in front of us. We have Katrina, you have the war in Iraq, you have climbing, skyrocketing gas prices. One reason California consumed so much petroleum over the past 20 years is because it was at relatively low price, and now that's climbing higher. In Hawaii, for instance, gas per gallon was about $3. They're 94% dependent on petroleum and coal, having no indigenous fossil fuels of their own. So I don't think this issue is going away. It's hitting people's pockets. It's hitting them personally. We're seeing permafrost melting in Alaska. Communities are being relocated. It's no longer a theoretical issue.
And think about it. Permafrost, it's supposed to be permanent, and it's melting. You mentioned Hawaii. We had a Republican governor from Hawaii on the show a few months ago, and she's making renewable energy the mainstream choice in Hawaii. So, you know, practicality rules. And it's too bad that it took, you know, gas pump politics, meaning how it's hitting people in the wallets, to wake them up to our SUVs. And, you know, now people are starting to value fuel efficiency. But where was the Senate in the wake of 9/11 when they voted against improving CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy? Trent Lizalot stood up and said, we'll all be driving purple people eaters. This will be the end of choice, the death of the SUV. Oh, my God, what a crisis that would be. And they voted against it. It was all because of the lobbyists. We cannot afford business as usual. We cannot afford politics as usual. And a plug, I got so angry as a mother that I founded a group called Don't Be Fueled, Mothers for Clean and Safe Vehicles, grassroots campaign promoting hybrids, not Hummers. Go to don'tbefueled.org, sign our petition. We're going to be delivering in Detroit. This is a question for Carla. Why did the Apollo Alliance oppose the Million Solar Roofs legislation? And how does it feel about the very similar program recently adopted by the California PUC?
That is an unfortunate misperception. The Apollo Alliance never opposed SB 1, Senate Bill 1. In fact, we submitted a number of different comment letters in support of the bill, recommending improvements to the bill that would benefit the populations that I discussed earlier. We, for instance, pushed for apprenticeship training requirements for local hire as well as for prevailing wage, which all fits within you know, public financing. As far as the Public Utilities Commission recent allocation of about $1 billion over an 11-year period for rebates, we supported that as well. And again, assuming that high standards would be applied. The reason the bill went down was not because of labor's opposition. That was one of the reasons why it failed. There was a lot going on. You know, it was a year when nobody wanted, and the legislature wanted to give the governor credit for this measure. The governor didn't want to give the speaker credit. You had that dynamic. And there was just a whole host of factors. And fortunately, we do have now the allocation of funding going in the direction of solar energy.
Question for Ken. Are there any solar panel installation companies that are already employing at-risk or foster care youth?
Yeah, actually, as part of that program, a couple of the installations, the kids were helping with that. Since this program's only about a year old, you know, they have to go through a series of learning and training before they can be apprentice and go through that program. But they're participating. The kids have rehabbed a house. They built furniture for the charter school, so they're doing programs. They just haven't done a solar installation by themselves.
This is a question for Sophie. Is the Love Life organization still operating? So inspiring, but of course one person had to do too much. For a minute I thought they were asking about my Love Life. Love Life organization. I never heard of that one, did you?
Either have I, but I really don't know whether it is or not. But I know that we had, there was a settlement, I think it was the Duke settlement, and San Francisco was given about $13 million. And with that money, people were asked to submit grants. And one was about renewable energy and training. And so in the Bayview, we probably have more solar panels than any other, I think, district. And in fact, there are churches with solar panels and homes with whole blocks with solar panels. And young people did the training, and they worked hard, and they, you know, made that happen. And I think they're still working in some of the very businesses that brought them in. So there is that hope, and people are doing that and training young people here in the city as well.
This is a question for Sophie. Can you suggest a good location in Bayview Hunters Point for the next meeting like this? Good idea. Well, preferably sure. With solar panels on the roof.
I think there are several churches, but I think the community college is one that I think is very appropriate because it's around the sewer plant. And I think, you know, that's going to be our next big issue is we're working on the sewer plant in San Francisco right now. We're looking at a $3 billion bond. So I think it would be a good place to have it, but that would be my choice, I think, would be the community college.
A question for Carla. So are the Green Wave investments creating green economy jobs?
It's too early to tell, but we are working toward that. The state teachers retirement system, for instance, is in the process of working with venture capital funds to make those investments. We're monitoring the progress. We're holding them accountable. Time will tell.
Okay. Supervisor Maxwell mentioned the city's electricity resource plan, but the city is falling behind schedule in meeting the goals of the ERP. The city is doing even worse in meeting the goals of its ambitious climate action plan. What can be done to make sure the city fulfills quite laudable goals? Yeah.
Well, I think it's your participation. I mean, we passed this bond that I mentioned earlier, but there were some loopholes that we had not thought about, and we couldn't use the money. And so, and that was about putting solar panels on all municipal buildings. And that has been something that we're still working with the PUC and our city attorneys. But I think in a lot of ways, we're looking at Hetch Hetchy, we're looking at solar and wind power coming down around Hetch Hetchy. So we're trying to really catch up. And I know on the Board of Supervisors, it's really something that we talk about, and it certainly is something that I'm thinking and talking about all the time. So I think if we've fallen behind, we're trying to work fast. But if we could use your help in reminding us. If you just come to a board meeting during public comment and mention it and say, hey, you guys, what's going on? I think it would be important.
Talk a little about when really community choice is in San Francisco and what we are up against in order to really get it.
Well, I think, as been mentioned, we are really on top of it. I mean, I think we're looking forward to. We have what's called LAFCO, and that meets it meets regularly in San Francisco. Ross Mirkarimi is a part of that. I think he might be chair of that committee. And so he's talking about community aggregation. He just mentioned there was just something that we passed a couple of weeks ago. So it's on our radar screen, and we're all looking forward to it. Carol Migden was a very great proponent of it. And I've known about it for a long time. So I'm very much, I think, would help San Francisco. And it's a tool. It's one thing that could really help us a lot. So I think we're all very much interested, and you should be hearing and seeing more about it.
Here's a good one for anyone. What can or should be done to ensure adoption of the draft California Climate Action Plan, in your view? Whoever wants to take that one.
Implement community choice in every community in California. Then follow for the rest of the states.
I'd say take advantage that this is an election year. The governor has executive orders on climate change. He's part of the Western Governors Association goals that they set to reduce emissions by certain levels. He's got to put his money where his mouth is. The Chronicle just recently had an editorial urging him to be greener. It's not enough to have an executive order. He needs to fund those initiatives and to get agencies to actually implement them to reach his goals.
And turn in his Hummers. People from his office tell me all the time, what does it matter what he drives personally if he's doing all these great green things? I said, credibility, integrity. Can you describe, Ken, in more detail, the risks posed by the many proposed LNG facilities that you mentioned?
Sure. The risks start with the extraction. You know, the extraction and where we're going to get LNG is coming from Russia. Russia has 27% of the natural gas world reserves. Qatar has about 15%. Iran has about 15%. Three or four other in the Middle East have, you know, another 5%. So we're going to be captive to the same dynamics that we have with oil if we shift into that. So, I mean, two solutions. You know, didn't mention thermal solar, but thermal and electricity generation with solar are both contributors to reducing our dependence on foreign fossil fuels.
We touched on this, Sophie, earlier, but this is actually for Carla or Ken or anyone. I love the concept of solar panels on schools, but as I drive in my hybrid anywhere in the state, I see so many housing projects, none with solar panels. Are Apollo or Sierra Club working in any way to encourage green building with developers?
And actually, there's a program called Zero Energy New Homes. We did workshops in the San Joaquin Valley. We had two builders commit to putting solar on every home that they're building after these workshops. It started off where the Sierra Club litigated a couple years ago for air quality accumulations and mitigations. So one of the requirements was that the builders were supposed to put solar in their model homes. Well, they weren't doing it because they said they couldn't do it, and they had multiple excuses. So we brought them all in a room. They had about a half hour to an hour of a bitch session about why they couldn't do it. Then we brought in the folks that showed them how they could do it. Two builders committed to putting it in every home because the market surveys show that people want it. So if you offer it just like you're going to offer granite countertops, you just offer it. It's part of the package.
By the way, granite countertops are not environmentally friendly. We're going to be remodeling our kitchen, and there's all kinds of great recycled glass that looks just as good as marble and is not so difficult because it doesn't have to be extracted, of course, other than from the recycling bin.
I was just going to add that also if you come at it from a different angle, Supervisor Maxwell earlier talked about the request for proposal process where you can issue a request to businesses and developers to bid on projects. And if you build into that requirements for green building standards, then that's only going to attract those developers. And if you know, one action plan is to work with your local government to get them to adopt some of these standards, such as building to what's called LEED standards, which is leadership in energy and environmental design, using recycled materials, conserving water, and that type of thing.
Come to the end of our written questions. If any of you have a spontaneous question, and this is your chance to be on the radio and let everyone out there listening know about your favorite cause or concern or question, here's your chance. Just keep it to a minute or two, please.
While you're coming up, I just want to say that San Francisco has the largest alternative fuel vehicle fleet in the United States of America. And we have over 1,000 vehicles that are alternative. Just to let you know.
That's how I get away with doing a national show from San Francisco, because everything starts here, it seems. So it's really an example of what can happen, what's possible elsewhere.
Yeah, hello. My question is actually for Supervisor Maxwell. I'm a member of the San Francisco Biodiesel Co-op. We've been working on a committee to help Muni, called Go Muni Bio, run biodiesel. It costs about $60,000 for a startup program and about $1 million to implement it. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on how we might overcome that obstacle. In our preliminary meetings with Muni, they're into it. They want to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think cost is a big issue, and I'd love to know what your thoughts would be on that.
Well, I mean, I think we keep saying to Muni and everybody else that we have to start somewhere, and that once we do get started, we'll find we have other partners. You know, we partner with Berkeley and with other some other people to really make some other things happen. So I think if they want to do it, that's the biggest hurdle. Because, yeah, if they really want to do it, and I think that they do, then we will find a way. If they bring us something, then we can find a way to maybe make it, not every fleet, but just do a model, and we can just use that one, see how it works. Thank you.
I would recommend bring investors to the table. As we know, there's a lot of money being poured into this area, and if they see a ready market, for instance, if you aggregate different public fleets together, you're going to have a lot more demand, and you can get long-term purchasing contracts, which in turn is going to increase the demand for growing some of the fuel stock, maybe the oil-based stock out of the Central Valley, for instance. Everybody needs that certainty, so I think that it's important to think beyond your usual stakeholder groups.
My name is Anna Halpern-Landy. I have a question for Supervisor Maxwell. First, I want to say, as a resident of Bernal Heights, thank you very much for your work on the Hunters Bay Point power plant. I also see it and am very happy to know that you've taken steps about that and for all your hard work. As a woman entrepreneur and a minority one at that, who is getting a green business started, actually a biodiesel business, to Carla's point. I'm very interested in hearing what sorts of programs that the city has to support green businesses such as mine.
Well, I think I don't know all of them, but I would suggest that you call the Department of the Environment, the PUC. Those are kind of especially the Department of the Environment. They're kind of the front runners right now and looking at our green businesses and looking at other ways that we can make those things happen. So that's where I would start.
Good evening, panelists. My name is Rick Galbraith. I'm the local vice chair of the local San Francisco Sierra Club group. My question is related to the announcement that you started to make, Supervisor Maxwell, but didn't actually get to, which was that the energy company whose name shall not be mentioned has gotten permission from the PUC to close the peaker plant at Hunter's Point. My question is, because we're talking about making or putting in its place green businesses, what is going to be done to prepare the local labor pool there for the businesses that are going to come in? Now, I know it's a number of years down the line, but it sounds like there are a lot of good synergies that could be had from the three panelists here. So what are we going to do to be sure that the jobs that are going to be created there are going to be going to the people that actually live there and that need them?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier about grants that were given to people in the area, some grants in Bayview. Actually, you have to be either in Petrero Hill or in Bayview. And so we have a lot of, there were at least two organizations that started training programs with contractors. And so I think that is beginning. And then after listening, I think City Build can do some of that as well.
My name is Eric Bowen. I'm with Sigma Capital Group. Anna, who spoke earlier about the biodiesel plant, she and I are business partners in that project. I have been appointed to the Mayor's Clean Tech Advisory Council, which is a group of business folks like myself who are looking at economic development opportunities for clean tech in San Francisco. We've had a couple of interesting ideas come to the council so far, and we're working on those. But I'm curious, from the panel's perspective, what ideas would you have that I could bring back to the council for harnessing the business environment here in San Francisco to help get a clean tech cluster going?
If you take a look at the example with the San Diego City Schools, that was financed by GE Capital. And they put in a $500 million fund for other schools to replicate that. So if you have a replicatable model that makes economic sense, you know, you just have to get a little creative with the financial folks.
And didn't you say, Ken, that you are working to get it replicated across the state and eventually the country, because it's
correct.
A win-win-win, as you said.
Yeah, and combined with the state treasurer, Phil Angelides' Green Wave Initiative, that's part of bringing all that capital and focusing it. You know, so if we have that focus and we're building that aggregation community by community, we have a chance to really scale it up. But along with that cluster, I would think that you'd want to have, you know, You've got redevelopments. You've got Hunter's Point. You've got Treasure Island. You know, when I was stationed at Treasure Island, there's a lot of buildings out there that could be utilized, and they're not being utilized currently. And obviously, they're going to have some redevelopment. But in the transition, you'd have a perfect for a business incubator and start to cluster it that way, where you have low cost, but then you have something that you can build on. And then having the leadership, you know, bring those folks together. You know, with the task force on the 6th, we're bringing the energy service providers. We've got BP, we've got Constellation. You've got a lot of big players. So if you've got a component that can feed into that, you need to get that information, because they're going to be looking for vendors to supply that. You know, you could have a cogen with biodiesel. Instead of diesel generators, why not have biodiesel generators for some of that backup? You know, why not a package with Kaiser Permanente to package it that way?
I think that some things that are needed is to find ways to create an attractive environment for business to come. And that depends on employment, trained workforce, land, available land, incentives that the city might offer, permitting process that is smooth and without hassle. And in the city of Oakland, we're trying to do this. We're trying to attract an unnamed solar company to set up a site in West Oakland, and these are the questions that we'll need to answer for them.
If there are no more questions, we've come to the fun part of the evening, and that's the action plans. We're going to ask each of our panelists to take a couple of minutes and just sum up, even though we've touched on some of their ideas, what they would like you to take home with you and spread around, you know, spread that green fairy dust everywhere you go.
Well, I think that there's a lot of work to be done, but most of this work starts with you. And I think that collective leadership is what really drives everything. And so whoever has the ball at the time is the leader. And then the rest of us come with the resources. So I think what's important here is your leadership, and that's why we are here where we are today in so many ways, is because of you all. So I would suggest that you continue with your leadership. Think about all the things that we've said and really help a lot and talk and write letters and email. But it really helps a lot, and be there. You know, when you hear things going on, try to be there. Try to be at those committee meetings. And even if you're not hearing it, go to the board. And at a certain time, you know, there's community input. Mention it. Talk about it. And people even say, Sophie, I'd like you to work on so-and-so. Or I'd like so-and-so. I mean, there's things that you can do. You are very, very powerful. And so remember your power and use it and help us all and help with that leadership on these very, very important issues.
Along the same lines, I would encourage you to try to influence all of the candidates who are running for election, whether it's local government, state, or federal. We're getting contacted by people who want to say, hey, I want to make this part of somebody's platform. And we have a report, several copies of which are on the back, called New Energy for States. And this lays out a number of case study examples in different parts of the country of things that governments, local governments, have actually implemented. So this is something you can actually give to a candidate running for office and ask for their feedback, ask how they would implement some of those, and give them ideas. For instance, a group of us is going to be meeting with former Congressman Dellums, who's running for mayor of Oakland, and we're trying to elevate this on his platform.
I'm still going to be focused on community choice. Call the mayor, call your supervisor, write a letter, send a letter to the editor at the Chronicle and the Guardian. You know, we have an opportunity to create energy independence in San Francisco. It's not going to stop at 50%. I can tell you that the director of environmental services for City of Chula Vista, and they've been heavily involved in this process also. You know, when they get to 40%, and if they built out 40% renewable in the city, somebody across town is going to say, when do I get my house done? When do I get my business done? They're going to go 100%. They're not going to stop at 40%. There's no reason to stop if you've got the financing in place, it's creating the jobs, it's doing the right thing. So we'll help support you with that. You know, and when the board probably sometime in mid-April goes to vote on the implementation plan, you know, show up at City Hall. You know, we should have thousands of people there saying, we don't want to bail out the utilities. We don't want to go to war for our resources. We don't want the air pollution associated with it. We want to change, and we need to change in a big way commensurate with climate change. You know, I try not to say global warming, because if you're in Michigan in the wintertime and you hear about global warming, that's not a bad thing. But climate change, it's unequivocal that it's happening. You know, the only party that's not paying attention is in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we're going to fix that in the next election, too.
Get the fossil fools out of the way. We are going to wrap up just about 9 o'clock. If you'll just bear with us for a few more minutes. Actually, bear with me. I had a couple comments. And one is, you just touched on how we need to broaden the definition of environment. You know, I think words are very important. I don't say the environment, or I try not to. It's our environment, because as soon as you breathe the air out there, it's in my lungs. As someone said, it's the environment. And that's the key, I think, is making the connections between environmental issues, natural resources, and health, our economy, national security. I mean, really, we have to broaden our view. We in this room do. But talk to your friends, talk to your family, talk to your enemies, talk to anybody, you know, about what's at stake here. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Debbie and I were talking on the way in. Her son has really bad asthma, and that's one of the reasons she's working so hard, you know, with EcoTalk and everything she can think of to do. We have, you know, newborns getting, you know, a dose of trace elements, but trace, who knows what happens when there's a lot of trace of different chemicals inside their body. Women actually have been measured with a certain number of chemicals in their body, and when they breastfeed, that goes down. And guess where that goes? You know, they've tested, the Environmental Working Group has tested umbilical cords in newborns, and 10 out of 10 had signs of chemical exposure before they've uttered their first cry. I mean, why is this not just, you know, outraging Americans right and left? It's a strange thing, this denial concept. I call it the COD syndrome. It's an acronym I made up for complacent, oblivious, and in denial. But thanks to, you know, a really scary storm season, I think people are starting to connect the dots. I just have one quick anecdote, unless you're giving me the hook. Okay. Okay. Oh, yes, ideas, yes, from the audience. I just want to share this one act. My sister-in-law, who lives in Miami Shores, Florida, whose politics are about as far from mine as can be. The only thing we have in common is her brother is my husband, but she's actually pretty cool, except she's a Republican, and doesn't believe in anything that I talk about, never really knew what I was doing so passionately, until she went 12 days and nights without electricity, in the heat of the day, in the dark of the night, and she called us about every other night and fetched, you know. Oh, God, and they don't even know when they're going to pick up the garbage, and no one can tell us when the lights are coming back on. We can't watch TV. And I listened, and I listened, and I listened, and I finally said, on the 12th night, Mary, I feel your pain. Guess what it feels like when you're an environmentalist or a scientist or any number of people who have been saying, we've got to make an eco-U-turn before we have climate chaos. I said, this season is the first of what's going to be really severe extreme weather, most likely. Can we prove that it's global warming induced? No. Is it better to err on the side of caution? Is it likely, since this is exactly what's been predicted, that this is beginning to arrive on our shores? I said, so that's painful when nobody's listening, because we've been talking about this, and you haven't been listening either, Mary. So she called me back. She was very quiet. She called me back the next night and said, Betsy, I finally get it. I said, you see, you know, hurricanes are an equal opportunity destroyer. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or a Democrat. You know, the environment is not just for progressives and liberals. So I said, so that's great, Mary. This is a really huge moment, you know. What are you going to do about it? She goes, well, I'm going to get a hybrid. I don't know if I can live in Florida anymore if these hurricanes are really going to get worse. I'm going to listen to your show. Yay! One more listener in Miami. Ted had something, and we want to get a few action items from the audience, and then we're going to end with a song.
Good evening. My name is Ted Postum, and I wanted to thank Betsy for getting this email out to me indirectly. I was in Brazil about the last week and a half, and when you fly up from the southern part of the hemisphere and you cross over the wonderful Amazon, and you come in over here, and you fly into Houston and fly over Nevada into California and see the difference between the Amazon and all the new piles we have in Nevada, it's nice to be able to go both sides. And what I wanted to do tonight was thank Betsy for bringing up my green collar under quotations on this sheet, because it drew my attention to get here right away. What I really wanted to do was thank you all. Supervisor Maxwell, you have a passion that's extraordinary. Carla, you're a fantastic person. You just went on, and you're totally passionate what you're doing. Ken, foster parenting, raising a single child, I know what it's like. It's a lot of passion, too. And Betsy, thank you.
Hello, my name is Allie Starr. I work at Ella Baker Center, and this has been a wonderful panel and a wonderful evening, and I thank you all. I've been a longtime activist in San Francisco, and now I'm in Oakland, and I wanted to just let the audience know that I work with the program that's in alliance with the Apollo Alliance, and we are producing a big event. It's produced by our Reclaim the Future program, Green Collar Jobs, Not Jails, linking environmental opportunity and jobs, and linking that specifically for people who've been formerly incarcerated, which has been discussed a little bit, and it was really wonderful to hear about that, those projects. So there is an action step that I want to encourage everyone to come out and support our Oakland brothers and sisters on Thursday, May 18th at 6 p.m. in Oakland at the James Irvine Conference Center at the Frank Ogawa Plaza, right near BART. You don't need to drive. And it's called the Oakland Solutions Salon, A Model City is Possible. It's 2 weeks before our mayoral election, and we're hoping that we can get some of the mayoral candidates to come out and hear the community. It's featuring Van Jones, the executive director of Ella Baker Center, Bruce Cox, who's with the Alliance for West Oakland Development and part of the Apollo Alliance, Majora Carter, who is a MacArthur Genius Award winner. She's my age. She's an African-American woman from the South Bronx and started a program called Sustainable South Bronx. She's phenomenal, greening and putting bike paths and greening the South Bronx area. We're really trying to build a sister relationship with the South Bronx and Oakland right now. And Geralina Fortier, who's with People's Grocery. She's a 19-year-old youth activist growing organic food and selling that food to the community in West Oakland. And co-sponsors include Urban Habitat, who's been mentioned, Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and others. So I hope people will come out. And if you want an email about it, I ran out of flyers today at another event, so come and give me your email, and I'll send you something tomorrow. Thanks so much, everybody.
Yes, again, thank you so much to Democracy Action and all the panelists for an excellent forum tonight. I really appreciate it. My name is Aaron Lamer. I'm with a group called Post Carbon Institute. And not to belabor the whole question about crisis, because I know that we all have crisis fatigue in this room, but we see another crisis coming to face our fossil fuel dependent society, and that is peak oil. The idea that increasing numbers of geologists and oil companies, et cetera, are coming to agree that we're, within the next 5 years, potentially facing the maximum point at which we can expect production to happen on this planet, which means after that, it's going to get increasingly expensive year after year after year. So that means we have a very short window of opportunity to transform our society away from fossil fuel dependence and toward renewable energy, reconfiguring our cities, making living and working closer together so it requires much less energy. And so our project, called Bay Area Relocalize, is going to be kicking off on March 31st from 7:30 to 10 p.m. at the Laney College Forum. And I'm happy to also say that we'll have a representative of Reclaim the Future and the West Oakland Apollo Alliance speaking there as well, Nicole Lee. And it'll also include the founder of Post Carbon Institute, Julian Darley, who has done a lot of assessment around natural gas markets and how we're going to be facing natural gas challenges in North America very soon, and along with David Room, who is my colleague and the director of municipal response for Post Carbon Institute. So that's going to be on the 31st at Laney College. And then the following day, we're going to be having a workshop on how we can relocalize our communities, bring energy, food production, essential services closer to home, so that we're going to be prepared to weather the storms of increased costs for fossil fuel energy. So I encourage you all to come out. Our website is bayarea.relocalize.net, and my friend and colleague Ingrid over here has flyers and registration forms if you're interested in taking part. So thank you so much again.
And you didn't even mention The End of Suburbia, a documentary everyone has to see.
Of course, of course. Thank you.
Fabulous.
To thank the panelists and the organizers for a great event. My name is Sonia Macy's, and I'm from Tucson, Arizona, where I run the Tucson Audubon Society. It's been a great opportunity to talk to a couple of people about the issues that you guys are dealing with out here. And I would just like to remind everybody, and Supervisor Maxwell said it, a gentleman from the Sierra Club said it, water is going to be an important part of the equation. And it's not just because I'm jealous that you guys have feet of rain, and in Tucson, Arizona, we go for 86 days straight without a drop. But, you know, we need to all come together around that resource issue and really try to make it work. So thank you very much for all of the other stuff that you're working on, but please don't forget about the water.
I'm Alec Bass with Democracy Action, and I really want to commend this outstanding panel for all of the wonderful ideas, Betsy, for the way she's moderated the people who are here this evening who are doing so many good things. You think about climate chaos, about renewable energy, about helping improve the life for the kids and everybody else in society, and it all comes together in various ways. Dave, for helping organize this, I mean, he did so much. But also just as we talk about action steps, we've got great ideas. We've got some great people working on things. We also need great leaders. And it's wonderful having Sophie here. We thank you for being here. We need more great leaders. We need people who are working to get great leaders. We need people registering voters. We need people encouraging people to bother registering to vote, to have faith that if they participate in this country, then they can make it better. We need to get out the vote. We need to elect people who will embrace these ideas, who will embrace the work that is being done. And we cannot let up until everything comes together. So thank you for helping us get there with all these ideas. And we hope that we can continue working with ideas and people and voters and help this country become a better place.
Thanks, Alex. And speaking of leaders, let's all vow to never let another presidential election pass where the environment is a four-letter word. And even the environmentalists like Clinton and Gore and Kerry, you know, don't talk about it. I mean, look at Gore and Clinton got green after they left the White House. What's up with that? They get it now, but they were too quiet when they were in a position of power, right? Then John Kerry comes along, my hero, because he spearheaded CAFE standard improvements with John McCain, and you barely hear about environmental issues. Like, who is muzzling them? Who is telling them that that's not something that Americans want to hear about? And isn't that the weakest link in this administration of all their weak links? And there's more than we ever could have dreamt. But that is something they should have slammed them on. So, you know, Kerry got an ecoectomy or something. Like, we cannot let that happen anymore. Remind them of what's most important. And finally, my action suggestion is listen to Eco Talk. We're the best kept secret in radio. It's free. It's informative. We have people like this on every single week who will inform you and inspire you. If you want to hear past segments without any commercials, we don't really have any commercials, go to ecotalk.net and you can just scroll down. We've got a long blog site and pick any topic that interests you and hear the whole 7-minute segment. A lot of the people that have been mentioned, Julie and Darley, great people have been on the show. And we green the red and blue states one show at a time. That's our new slogan. So I just want to, can I end with a quote? And then Dave's going to close out. Two more minutes. Professor Donella Meadows, did any of you know her? She passed away in 1995. She was one of my sheroes, very inspiring author, educator, environmentalist extraordinaire. She wrote, someday, and this was in 1995, there's a reference to Newt Gingrich in there, so I don't have to stop and explain that. Someday the media will learn that the environment is not an intermittent news story, not a special interest, not a win-lose sports event, not a movement, and not something to pay token attention to one day a year. It's a beat far more important than Wall Street or Washington. Its laws are stronger than Newt's. Its moves more important than the Federal Reserve's. Its impact overwhelms the stock market or the next election. The environment is not one player in the field. It is the field. It holds up or fails to hold up the whole economy and all of life, whether or not the spotlight is on it. So on that note, I just want to personally thank Dave and Debbie and Aaron and Alec. I can tell you a lot of work went into tonight, securing the place, coming up with an intriguing title that would bring all of you out on a rainy night, and picking the panelists, of course. And it's a labor of love. They don't get paid for that. So another round of applause for all of them. And also the Quake for caring enough to be here to record this and to air it hopefully soon. And we're hopefully after Dave has some closing comments, you'll stick around for another couple minutes and play. You'll hear a song that was playing as you sat down, but we're going to play it in its entirety. And if you listen to the words, a friend of ours, Bob Wickline, wrote it. He was inspired by Eco Talk, so it was our theme song for about a year. It's called Take Our Heads Out of the Sand. After Katrina, Rita, Wilma, Oprah, we decided, okay, people are getting their heads out of the sand, so it's not a theme song anymore, but it's a great song, and just take that with you if you will. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Betsy, for a wonderful job. We waited, what was it, since last August to finally bring you back here again, and it's really been worth it. I just wanted to mention that community choice is really something you can get involved with. It really leverages a lot. When San Francisco goes solar to this degree, there are a number of other cities in California that are watching, you know. And this, when San Francisco does it, they'll be ready to go because we'll have shown the way. So there is literature on the back table about community choice, and which includes letting you know how you can get directly involved in supporting the passage of community choice in San Francisco. Okay? Thank you so much for coming out on this rainy evening. It's been pleasant, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks so much to our panelists, Sophie and Carla and Ken. I had met Sophie, but not Carla and Ken before, and it's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot for all the great work that you're doing. Good night.
Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see, if ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we. As we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed? Oh, little couple.